Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. If you love books and believe history should be preserved, New York Times bestselling novelist Catherine Neville joins us near the end of today's show. She's been on the show a couple of times before, but this time she joins us as an ambassador for the Smithsonian Libraries to tell us about its Adopt a Book program. First, I'm very pleased to be joined in the studio by Kathleen Alcala. I want to make sure I'm saying her name right. I think I screwed it up. We'll check in a minute. Her new book is described as wildly ambitious, a book that pulls together cultural and cross-cultural experiences, environmental and food debates. It's the story of how place-based foods infuse community. And according to author Gary Paul Naban, Alcala is one of the finest writers ever to emerge from the Pacific Northwest. I would agree with that, Kathleen.
Thank you so much. So, I really appreciate it. Well, can I use that quote from you as well?
You may. You may. Well, let's tell listeners, your latest nonfiction book is called The Deepest Roots, Finding Food and Community on a Pacific Northwest Island. As I said, you live on Bainbridge Island, so I really appreciate you being here today with us in the studio. It's nice to have you here. I've heard you say you're more of a listener than a talker, but we're all family here, so, and it's all local. We're talking all local stuff today. So in addition to your new book, which we'll get to in a moment, you're the author of a collection of essays, The Desert Remembers My Name, on Family and Writing, three novels, and a collection of short stories. So I want to begin our conversation today with why you became a writer, because I think maybe this influenced the way you approached the book. You said you grew up surrounded by the stories of aunts and uncles from Mexico, and often they were stories with no endings.
Right, right. It's a different type of storytelling. And later people described my writing as magical realism, but really it was born in the sorts of stories I grew up hearing, which are fragmented and mixed in with history and lots of other things, to, in the end, tell a story that you have to pretty much complete on your own. It's a way of teaching culture as well as sharing stories.
Right. And so well done. So I want to ask what inspired this book. I understand that you wrote a couple of essays and had an extraordinary response from them that kind of got you thinking.
Right. I wrote an essay in which I interviewed four of the people who are in the book, two couples who left other occupations to become farmers, to return to the land. And they were people I had known before in the book business or in some other business. And I just thought that was an extraordinary choice to make in this day and age, to become a farmer, because it's really hard. It's really hard work. So I interviewed them and wrote the essay called Sweet Life, which is the name of one of the farms, Sweet Life Farm. And people really responded to it. I found that there seems to be a fantasy at the back of many people's heads that, oh yes, if I just had a couple of acres, I would become a farmer and I would grow fruit, and somebody else clearly would grind the wheat to make the bread.
It's a lot of hard work, and that's evidenced in the stories that you tell in the book. So let's talk a little bit about how the book is set up, because it's part memoir, it's part history, it's part science, a lot of great personal stories in there.
Thank you.
And you said that there's nothing like confronting your own mortality to make you take a good hard look around and within, which really began the odyssey of this book for you.
Right. I'd say the inciting moment was my doctor calling me at 8 a.m. one morning to say, your cholesterol is 300. You have to make an appointment and come in right now. And my response was, I think, at first, besides surprise, was just anger, because I thought, I can take care of this. I can just modify my diet. There's no excuse for having this this level of cholesterol in my body. But then as I began doing the research, I realized that there was a lot more to it than what I had control of. Not only in what choices we make every day, but what's available to us, and then back to the whole genetics thing, which is that I've inherited something called metabolic syndrome from probably my Opata Indian ancestors in northern Mexico, meaning that I have the sort of genetics that count on doing the hard work and chasing down that rabbit if I'm going to have protein in my diet. And just a lot of things that are not that easily adapted to a modern sedentary lifestyle.
Right, right. And just to share a little bit more of your background, you grew up on far from the edge, you say, of the Mojave Desert. Mm-hmm. You lived in Colorado. You also lived in Seattle before moving to Bainbridge.
Yes.
But you say there's a huge difference between, you know, growing a couple of lettuces in the backyard, right, as you kind of touched on earlier, and actually doing the farming. And you realize that you had to really go in depth and start talking to people about how they did this.
It was not only how they did it or why they did it. I found that people had very different, I guess, worldviews depending on what their ethnic heritage was. So, for example, I interviewed a couple, Paul and Lorraine Svornich, who are third-generation Croatians who are fishermen on Bainbridge Island. And Paul has a wonderful philosophy about how he came to it from his father and grandfather, but he's always wanted to fish sustainably, so he went to great lengths to find the right kind of boat and the right fish to catch in order to live up to his own ideals and continue that particular heritage.
Yeah. And so you also look to the, this is where I was staggered. I was staggered to learn some of the history of the island. I did not realize how cross-cultural it was.
And I didn't either.
Until you began your research.
Right.
Right. And so you started looking at the earliest island residents for clues about how to approach rising temperatures and vanishing snowfalls. So tell us about that a little.
Well, for 10,000 years, the Suquamish have lived in the area and still have the reservation right across Agate Pass from Bainbridge Island. But all of the time before white people came, they fished and gathered clams seasonally on Bainbridge Island. It was just an extension of their territory. And during those seasons, they would live along the beach. They would just camp and fish during the day and smoke fish at night. So they also had cultivated camas fields and used a lot of the plant life that's on the island. I had, you know, it's such a big deal now for people to go foraging, and you can even hire someone to take you foraging and collect plants. But until I went to a workshop at the University of Washington about it, I had no idea that there were so many edible plants just growing naturally around us. So the Suquamish worked in conjunction with nature to gather their food. It wasn't the sort of thing to be sort of put in its place. It was something to be encouraged and cultivated in such a way that complemented the lifestyle that the Suquamish lived.
Interesting. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to have you ask you to read something from the book, and we're going to go more in depth into the book. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Kathleen Alcala. I remembered how to say it. Her new book is called The Deepest Roots, Finding Food and Community on a Pacific Northwest Island. It really is an awesome read. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
it's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair, host of Conversations Live, heard Mondays at noon and Fridays at 6 a.m. KKNW is running its annual listener survey right now. This is a great opportunity for you to tell station management exactly what you want from KKNW. You can tell us about your favorite shows, your likes, your dislikes, the kind of topics you'd like to hear about, and the type of guests you'd like to hear from. Your input really does help shape the future programming of the station. And as host of Conversations Live, it helps me produce better shows and give you what you want. When you fill out the survey online, you also have a chance to win a great prize. Just go to 1150kknw.com and click on 2016 Listener Survey. You could win $400 in gift certificates to Quinault Beach Resort and Casino at Ocean Shores and $100 in gift certificates to the Melting Pot Restaurant. Go to 1150kknw.com and tell us what you think.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. You're not alone if you believe a dominant, authoritarian patriarchy is destroying countless lives along with our planet. Goddess 2.0, advancing a new path forward, suggests a more sustainable alternative. And author Karen Tate will share insights from the new anthology. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, bringing you topics ranging from meditation to conservation, business and careers, to health and wealth.
Real people, real life, real radio. Alternative Talk, 1150.
Now I'm a farmer, and I'm digging, 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 digging. Now I'm a farmer.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. I am so pleased to be joined in the studio by Kathleen Alcala, we'll say this right by the end of the show. Her book is called The Deepest Roots, Finding Food and Community on a Pacific Northwest Island. And I want to just begin this segment, Kathleen, by looking at some of the questions that you put in the forefront of your mind as you began writing the book. You talked with food sellers and farmers and anybody who had any kind of history to
anyone
share.
Anyone who touched the food along the way.
Right, right. And you said in the beginning you felt foolish asking questions, but the more people you interviewed, the more relevant your questions seemed. And some of those were, I had to laugh at this one, as I'm sure many people have. Should I admire or feel disdain for the friend who picks up and eats roadkill?
Right.
Did you figure that one out?
I admire the couple I know who do this, but I'm not inclined to follow their example. Let's put it that way.
I actually remember coming back from a fishing trip with my dad and my uncle, and the car in front of us hit and killed a pheasant, and my uncle jumped out of our car and picked it up and took it home. So it made me think of that. You also asked, am I asking these questions to ingratiate myself with my food-producing friends just in case?
Well, that became sort of a running question, was what would I need to do to get food from you in a food emergency? And some people had very specific things in mind. They said, oh, you'd need to be able to field dress an animal, meaning I'd need to be able to skin and clean an animal if they expected help from me in the food department. And other people said there really isn't anything because we would keep, they didn't say it in so many words, but the idea that they would keep the food for themselves.
Right. And a big question, I would think, is you asked yourself, do the relatively wealthy residents of Bainbridge Island differ from the survivalists you knew when you lived in Western Colorado?
Right. Was the ideology that different, I think, was my question there. And yes, I would say right now, I happened to have visited Paonia this summer, again, after many years. And they're both a little bit delusional in terms of how much work it would be to really do this. But I think that the reasons are different still in the two populations.
Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. So would you like to read us a little segment from the book, and if you would just set this up for our listeners?
Sure. Salmon is the miracle that happens every day, whether or not we see it. Loggers and builders and the Army Corps of Engineers have done their best to destroy them, but salmon are the lifeblood of this part of the world, the bright corpuscles traveling up and down the veins and arteries of rivers, whooshing in and out of Puget Sound like blood in a heart. We have told each other that progress is a good thing, damming the rivers, draining the swamps and estuaries, hardening the shores with bulkheads and breakwaters. But our hearts remember, and the fish, generation after generation, remember and return each year in case we finally acknowledge them and let them in. So I think in all of my research, I had to finally acknowledge that salmon are the basis of all life in the Northwest. And we need to look at how we're treating the environment and why we're not making that a priority in terms of our relationship to the land and sea around us. I set the book up so that each chapter starts with a little bit of memoir about me and my relationship with food, starting with growing up in the desert and living here as an adult. The middle part is about the research and interviews I did for the book. And the last part is going back to the salmon and that notion of deep time, that we have to think of this in terms that far exceed each of our individual lifetimes, in terms of, do we really want this island to continue to thrive and survive?
Right. And the story of your island is the story of many islands.
Yes.
You said this, working with people on the island, listening to their stories, you telling their stories, this was an intensely collaborative piece of work.
It certainly was. I couldn't have written the book without the cooperation of many people and the indulgence of the farmers to have me tagging along. Like, oh, look at that. What are you doing?
So did you know many of them before you started the book, or have you made all these friends in the course of
researching? I knew about half of them, and there wasn't any scientific approach to who I interviewed for the book. It was sort of, oh, you should talk to this person, or you should talk to that person. The only population I had to really reach out and convince, using all of my persuasive powers to interview them, were the Indipinos. And this is a population on the island whose fathers were Filipino workers who came over, oh, in the 20s and 30s to work, who married First Nations women who had come down from Canada to help in the berry harvest that used to be the main cash crop on Bainbridge Island. So now we have a whole population that's unique to Bainbridge of people who call themselves Indipinos. And to this day, the men cook. They brought spices from the Philippines that were new to the Northwest. And the women forage and knew which were the foods that were indigenous and good to eat.
That sounds like a great partnership.
Isn't that great?
So a couple of other people you talk about, Bob and Nancy Fortner, who had been Winslow booksellers before turning their homestead into Sweet Life Farm.
Right.
Tell us about them.
That was, as I said earlier, part of the beginning of this book was an interview with them. They have 10 acres now. They farm about 1 acre of it intensely and turn it into what are called value-added products. I also had to learn all of this new sort of retail agricultural language of what does it mean on how we consume things. So they make things like cosmetics and beverage additives like bitters, all from products that they grow on their little farm. And they also grow chickens or raise chickens and raise almost all of the food that they eat at home.
I was surprised. You just mentioned the Filipinos played a huge role and still do. Mm-hmm. And also many Croatian settlers there, too. This is what really made me see Bainbridge Island kind of differently, I think.
Yes, it was a slightly different population than populated Seattle at that time. One of the things I realized, and I'd been kind of working on this theory for a while with my other books, is that very few people come to something. This whole notion of manifest destiny really doesn't hold up under scrutiny. People are usually running away from something. They're running away from starvation. They're running away from war. They're running away from political oppression. So the same things that bring people to the United States and the Northwest today are the same things that were bringing people 20, 50, 100 years ago.
Yeah. And yet Bainbridge Island, you write, has, it does not have good soil. It's not a natural kind of environment.
It varies across the island. I happen to live in an area that does not have good soil. Other places, the glaciers dropped a little soil, and so they're rich farmland. So as you go across the Bainbridge landscape and look at it like a geologist, you will see areas that have been scraped by the glaciers and areas where soil was dumped. And you also see these big rocks that are called glacial erratics that were left behind by the glaciers.
Mm. Big difference between how those on Bainbridge farm food and how someone like your sister in Fargo would farm food. And you share conversations in the book that you had with your sister while you were putting this together.
Yes, and I didn't start thinking that I would include her as part of the book, but the contrast seemed so extreme that eventually I thought, oh, I have to talk about this, because she and her husband have a traditional farm of over 1,000 acres in North Dakota, and it's dry land farming, meaning they depend on rainfall in order to plant the crops and have them mature and harvest them.
And they don't live on the farm now, right?
I read
he commutes an hour to...
About an hour, yeah, from Fargo. They live in town in Fargo now, out to where most of the property is, which is close to the Red River. And they can farm this many acres with so few people because they use combines. They do have a couple of seasonal employees, but it's a very different type of farming from Bainbridge, where a few farmers will farm just 4 or 5 acres at a time, and they do all the work themselves and don't use the big combines. They use old tractors that have been on the island for many years.
Mm-hmm. And so we have to mention Monsanto, the company we've talked about many times on the show before. You and your sister have differing viewpoints on that, so share those.
Well, her viewpoint is changing as time goes on, in that she readily admitted that farmers, in the sense that it's been going on since the 50s, are sort of beholden to Monsanto because they have a lock on almost every seed that they use. And I think that she has come to resent this more and more as they look at turning their business over to their son, that they really don't like being told basically what they can grow and how they can grow it, and that they have to buy the same seeds every year from the same company. And when you think of that globally, it's really a tragedy, mm-hmm, because it means that farmers in other places where the crops might have failed don't have a choice. They don't have any alternate. They must buy seeds again from Monsanto.
Mm. Did you change any of your original perceptions when you went into this? We all go in, no matter how much we try not to, with our own perceptions on a topic. Were there any big major turnarounds for you?
A couple. One was that I went in and would ask people things like, well, how much sunlight does it take to grow tomatoes? And how many days does it take you to do this particular task? And it turned out that the most important factor in terms of growing food was nothing having to do with the weather or the landscape, but the amount of human labor that goes into it. And that's really what we're dependent on. I realized that we're essentially dependent on a food system that demands underpaid laborers, which is really a form of slave labor. And as long as we're bringing food, even from as close as California, we're dependent and we're part of that system.
Mm. So let's talk about where all of your food does come from, because even though you have many farmers and food producers there, you still rely on outside sources for,
yes,
much of your food.
Yes. We can't grow wheat yet on the island. They are working on different types of wheat that might grow in such a cool, low sunlight climate. Much of our food comes from eastern Washington, which in a way is a good thing because it means that the two parts of the state must learn to cooperate with each other. We,
right,
have to get along at the legislative level, at the level of our food and retail. We need to have access to that food. The farmers on Bainbridge sort of talked about the farmers in eastern Washington as though they wouldn't exist unless the Columbia River had been diverted to provide water for them. And that's true. But really, how would so many people live in Western Washington unless that food was available?
Yeah. I know that you, like many people, when you do buy processed food, read the labels, but you say that's not necessarily enough. And after interviewing the Nakata cousins, you learned the difference between farm-to-table and factory organic.
Right.
A big difference there, right?
There is a big difference. And one of the examples I used was looking at what was labeled an organic chicken and finally finding the label on the bottom. And it was barely organic, but it was affordable. And so the Nakata cousins talk about Town and Country, which is this wonderful grocery store, by saying that it is a grocery store of choice, that they allow people to make up their own minds about what kind of food they're going to buy and eat. So, of course, if everyone bought only truly organic food and were willing to pay the extra money for it, then the grocery store would stock more of that sort of thing. But there is a balance in what they carry so that they can keep it affordable and keep it accessible to people of all income groups on the island.
Right. So who are the main growers? Who grows most of your food then on the island?
There is a farmer named Brian McWhirter who grows food both on and off the island, and he supervises many other farmers. I realize that to be a good farmer, one of the traits you need is to be a good manager. You have to know how to manage your own time and the time of other people, so that when you set someone to a task, you can say, try to finish picking garlic by noon, right? And then we'll meet up and we'll decide what to do with the rest of the afternoon. So Brian also grows the organic produce now for Town and Country Market. The Nakatas have contracted with him to grow food in greenhouses on their family farm, which has lain fallow for many years since the whole family was sent away to the internment camps in Idaho during World War II. After that, we really invented ourselves as an agricultural island, and a few of the Japanese Americans came back, but many did not.
Yeah. One of the things that I lost my train of thought there. Sorry. I was thinking about something you'd said earlier and I was going to bring in. Oh, the salmon. Mm-hmm. So the renewal cycle is something that you say is probably the biggest part of this whole issue that we tend to overlook or brush aside.
Right. Because as long as we see salmon in the grocery store, we figure, oh, here's some salmon. They must be okay. But almost all of it is brought from Alaska. And the Puget Sound system is severely disrupted right now. We need to clean up the waterways. We need to give access back to the streams and rivers. Bainbridge only has streams, but many of them are blocked, so the salmon don't return. I have to say that one of the things that really gave me hope in writing this book was the coming down of the dams on the Elwha River. And after 100 years, the salmon were right there with their little calendars. They knew it was time. And they went all the way upstream on the Elwha. And I just thought, yes, they're all just waiting out there. The other thing that I learned in going to a couple of these conferences about food with indigenous people was that the old people said that the salmon taste the water. And when they can taste the salmon, when they can taste the cedar from their own stream, they follow that taste and go all the way back. So when the rains come, the heavy rains come in the fall, it washes that taste out into the sound and into the Pacific, and the salmon follow that all the way back to their exact place of birth.
It's interesting because I had to adopt a baby fry when I took a marine biology class a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they do not have an easy life. I have
no.
A lot of admiration for salmon.
And did you name your baby fry?
I think I did, but I don't remember what it was.
Because I have a rule that I established in the book, which is don't name your food.
Yes, I can see why. How have you changed the way that you live day to day? After researching, and this took you 6 years to research and to write. You didn't even have a publisher, I understand.
I write my books just to write my books with some irrational faith that somebody will understand what I was doing and think that other people might be interested. So I was very, and I knew it was a very local book, But I was pleased to have two publishers interested in it right away and go with the University of Washington Press. I have changed how I look at food and how I shop for food. As I say in the book, I was put on a couple of different diets that are supposed to help bring down your cholesterol. And one thing I realized is we still don't really understand that much about how our bodies work and how we metabolize our food. I'm much more conscious about what I buy and where it comes from, and I'm much more likely to spend more money if it's the type of food that I think is good for me. One thing that we need to work on, both locally and nationally, is the best food for you is that that comes from the closest to you. It not only retains its nutrition, it also cuts down on all of the oil that we're using, all the transportation costs, and puts people to work who live right around us. We mm-hmm. need to be able to do that. We need to look at each other and say, yes, I'm eating food that you helped me grow. I'm eating food that I bought from you. I'm eating food that I bought from a company where I know the people who run the company. So if I'm into this thing now of the more local we can get, the better it is for us.
Right, right. I going back to what we talked about earlier about organic versus, you know, farm to table, factory. I'd never really made that comparison before. So I think that was a significant learning point for me.
And the definition of factory organic, meaning a large company bought up a smaller company and now has many smaller companies that it essentially manufactures food the same way that non-organic companies manufacture food. But it can still be called organic because there's not a strict definition of it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the future of Bainbridge Island. We were chatting before the show started, and you said the thing you came out with after researching this was hope. And that's good. So talk to us a little bit about why you're hopeful.
I'm hopeful because I can see that we can make a difference locally if we modify our shopping habits, if we do try to grow some of our own food. In fact, one of the farmers, Betsy, I'm going to forget her last name now, said that she liked it that people were starting to grow more of their own food, even if it meant that they grew less from the farmer's market. It's Wittig, Betsy Wittig, because it meant that they understand where their food is coming from. And that's important to her. She was one of the farmers who really wanted to tell me the story of the food. And so by getting together, and we will have to, I mean, we're looking at what might be a less compassionate government in the near future. And so if there are emergencies, we're going to have to be thrown back on our own resources. We're going to have to work together, whether our politics agree or not, or however our relationship to the land has been before then. I need to be nice to those people who know how to dress roadkill, right? I have to be willing to work hard for the Fortners because they're willing to trade me food for labor. And other people are as well. So the other thing was there was recently an earthquake drill right in the Puget Sound area. We failed miserably in terms of emergency responses. And Bainbridge Island is going to be on its own for a long time if we're separated from the mainland by the ferry going down or other emergencies. We need to work together. But it's possible. It really can happen.
Right, right. So you say this, of course, is not just my book. It belongs to all the people who said, who shared their personal opinions. Crackpot theories.
those are mine, mostly.
hard-won scientific knowledge and precious time as they shared their stories with you. But best of all, they shared their food with you.
Yes.
And one of the things you talk about a lot throughout the book is get to know your neighbors. So give people advice about how they start building community around.
One of the best ways to do it is to participate in a community garden. I rent space for $50 a year in a community garden that's on private land. But you get to know the other people who also grow their food there. And the garden also contributes to our local food bank as well. So this is a place where a lot of food is produced that is distributed just locally. So you see what grows there, you see who's growing it, and you see their approaches. You can ask for advice on slugs. You can ask for advice on what's a good late-season vegetable to grow. You can trade kale with people. And my favorite vegetable, as I say in the book, is the carrot. So year after year, I try to grow the best carrots. I have to say last year was my best year. It was a little wet this year.
I have to say I live down in South Sound, and I'm surprised by how many, even very close to the center of town, there are a lot of community gardens.
Yes.
And some people who don't really want to garden themselves offer up their garden for those who want to.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, I thought that would be nice for me too.
That's kind of a new thing. And I think that they have changed the regulations, at least in Seattle, for people to farm at home. It's now allowed to keep chickens under, you know, the right conditions in your backyard. But also, if you have property that you're not farming that's suitable, you can turn it over to a farmer who will farm it for you and sell it or use it or trade it and maybe give you some of it back.
Yeah.
So we're starting to look at our landscaping in a new way.
Yeah. I know we have a lot of educators that listen to the show, and one of the things I loved was all of the education that's happening
yes.
on Bainbridge Island. And I'm just going to mention this one. You can talk about others if you want. It's a nonprofit learning center called Islandwood, which brings Seattle school children to Bainbridge.
Right. And it was started by Paul and Debbie Brainerd when they bought the property there and realized what a beautiful place it was and what potential it had. So mostly Debbie has done the work in setting up Islandwood. And it acts as a learning center for children who come out for 3 or 4 days and live at Islandwood and pick the food and prepare the food and eat the food and weigh the waste afterwards to see how much of it they actually weighed. And the best part is they have composting toilets that they can look at from the outside.
Oh, they do?
So it has a cutaway view. So the children love that, of course. And then they go back to Seattle, and sometimes I think they get to take a little plant back with them. But I hope that there are children who get that bug and think, yes, this is something that I can do. I see the act of farming as something that is not only a lot of hard work, but can be very healing. And I know that there's at least one program in the Puget Sound where veterans are engaged in farming, many of them who are returning from the Iraqi wars in the Middle East are in need of spiritual healing, and being outside and being with the garden and growing things, nurturing things instead of destroying them is a great help for them.
Yeah, I actually talked with, I forget his name now, it's Chris Brown, I want to say, up in close to the Canadian border.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a returning veteran and has PTSD.
Right.
And so he started, I think it's called Grow a Farmer, an
oh,
organization called that.
Yeah.
And he only, it's volunteer run, and they're all veterans returning who have PTSD, and it's really helping.
I think we're going to need a lot more of that. We're going to have healing programs that integrate people gently back into society.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, we're almost at the end of our segment here, but I want to just share what we can do, because that's what this is all about. You say in the book that it's not enough just to read about it. It's too passive. You have to, and you became a passionate advocate for
yes.
this as you were researching.
Yes, I feel that there's a lot that we can do besides just go to the grocery store and buy food. The first thing, of course, is to grow some of our own food, as I said, in something like a community garden. You can also subscribe to a CSA, which is fairly easy, a community-supported agriculture, in which you pay a farmer up front for food that you will receive throughout the season. And they put together a basket for you each time, and you can either pick it up at their farm or you can pick it up at the farmer's market. I think there's one that will deliver on the island.
So just say what CSA is. It's a community...
Community-supported agriculture.
Okay.
So, in other words, you're subscribing ahead of time for food that a farmer will then proceed to grow for you. So one of the things that I realized is that it all depends on who has access to the land. So people who can own land can choose to farm it or not, but they can also give access to it to other people. And there might be people who can't afford land, but they can certainly put in the labor to help grow food locally. And there are many different variations on that, as we've seen through the educational programs and what I've researched for this book.
Well, an incredible amount of hard work went into this. And I know you said it's a very collaborative effort, but it took a master to pull all that together.
Oh,
so well done. Kathleen Alcala is my guest. The book is The Deepest Roots, Finding Food and Community on a Pacific Northwest Island. And if you think we covered a lot of topics, there's a ton more here in the book to read.
And I'll be at Elliott Bay Books on January 10th.
January 10th. I looked that up this morning.
Thank you.
And so we'll remind listeners closer to the date, because I'm sure many would like to see you. A final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Kathleen?
Just the notion, that we need to work cooperatively in order for this to, in order for us to succeed as our favorite species ourselves, right? Even more than the fish. If we want to survive as people, we need to work together to help recover the land and help the land to heal.
Great. And I know listeners can find out more about Kathleen Alcala at her website, which is Kathleen Alcala. I'll spell the last name. Well, Kathleen is with a K and two E's, and it's A-L-C-A-L-A. And there's a ton of information up there about the work that she's doing. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I appreciate it.
And please do stay tuned. We will be joined by Catherine Neville when we come back. We'll be talking about the Smithsonian Library's Adopt a Book program, which you can be part of if you choose. Stay with us. This is Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. You're not alone if you believe a dominant, authoritarian patriarchy is destroying countless lives along with our planet. Goddess 2.0, Advancing a New Path Forward, suggests a more sustainable alternative. And author Karen Tate will share insights from the new anthology. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Vicki Draper, the Healing Your Animal expert, we cover the world of animals. This week, November 27th, it's an encore presentation of Animal World. Tune in to hear our last Talk With Your Animals Sunday with gifted animal intuitive, communicator, medium, and Reiki master Darcy Pariso. Your Darcy help listeners talk with their animal and human loved ones on this side or the other on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Self-help, healing, spirituality, and more on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Salmon Falls.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we are going to end today's show with Catherine Neville. She's a New York Times bestselling author of The Eight, The Fire, The Magic Circle, and other books. And she's been on the show a couple of times talking about her books. But today we're talking about the Smithsonian Library's Adopt a Book program. It's a way that Americans help preserve literary history. Catherine Neville, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I know it's been a couple of years at least since we last talked, and I saw on your website you've been moving a lot, you've been traveling a lot, and you just mentioned to me you've been with the advisory board of the Smithsonian Libraries for 6 years. So let's just dive right in here and say, what is this Adopt a Book program about?
Well, a lot of libraries and museums started programs a number of years ago to rescue books. For us at the Smithsonian Libraries, there are two reasons why we wish for people to adopt books. One is to preserve them, because we have 2 million books, and a great many of those books are very rare books, where we, the Smithsonian, have the only copies. And I should pause to say that there are 21 libraries. People always say to me, I didn't know the Smithsonian had a library. They think of it as just the castle. We actually have a number of museums and research facilities, all the way from the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum in New York to the Panama Canal, where we have the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute that I believe has been studying flora and fauna down there since before the canal was dug, or just about the time that they were digging the canal. So we have these incredible books in each of these museums. Oh, National Air and Space is one. We have the Dawn of Flight is in there. Oh. All the books are really fascinating. Journals of astronauts, all kinds of great things. And all those books belong to us, the American people. I keep stressing to my fellow board members that people don't realize, number one, that we have these 21 libraries with all these amazing books, but they also don't realize that we own them. We people, the people of the United States, own them, and we can go and see them and visit them when we're in Washington. If you have a school group or something like that, they're sort of hidden away inside the museums, but you just call up or email and say, I have a group, and we'd like to come and see the letters of Galileo.
Right.
They're in the library of Dibner Library of Science and Technology. So the other reason that we ask people to adopt a book or provide books for them to adopt is if it's an unusual book that we would like to acquire for our collection, because it would round out the collection in one of the museums. And I adopted myself, we had a party on November 16th. That's why we're trying to get the word out. And the party was in the castle, and we brought out, I don't know, 50, maybe 50 books. I don't have the exact number. No, we brought out 80 books.
82 books?
80 rare books, and some of them were books we want to purchase, and others are books that we want to preserve for the future. And the one that I adopted was a book to build the collection, and it's called The Applications of Aerospace Technology in Industry. It's a 1971 book, and it was one of the first books that said all the different things they discovered during the Apollo missions in science, and how they were used, these discoveries were used and made profitable in industry. So I thought that would be a really neat book for us to have in the library, and I'm as soon as we have it, I'm going to run right over and look.
Yeah.
Read it.
So book adoptions, I mean, anybody can adopt a book by making a donation, I understand.
And yes, when, and they when have you a would... little, it's actually online. You can go right to smithsonianlibraries.edu. And I think somewhere up there on the front page it says you can click on adopt a book. But I can also give you the, what is it called, URL?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's actually, just for information, library.si, for Smithsonian Institution.edu, and then you have a slash that says donate and a slash that says adopt Pharma-A-Book.
Okay, so let's take a look.
Sort of a mouthful, and that's why I sometimes suggest, instead of trying that, just to go right to smithsonianlibraries.edu. But don't forget it's edu for education.
Right.
No, so let's take a look. Org or whatever.
No, it's education, edu. So let's take a look at one of the books that I saw was up for adoption. Maybe it's already gone, I don't know, but this sounded fascinating. The Savoy Cocktail Book. First edition of an iconic Art Deco publication, and it's, they say it's the most important cocktail book ever published.
That's great. What number is it? So I can look it up in my little chart.
Well, you know what? I don't have a number book, but I've got a little blurb here, so I'll read it out. The foundational work, they describe it as a foundational work of modern culture. It's made up of cocktail recipes created and compiled by Harry Craddock of the Savoy Hotel, dubbed the greatest barman to have ever lived. He apparently completely revolutionized the drinking scene, and the book is still in print today. It was published in 1930, and it's still in print today. So,
And how much is it to adopt it? Some of them are quite expensive.
I don't know. It doesn't have a price here, but, you know, it's just a sample of one of the books that is up for, and this sounds like quite a classic. So,
well, if I see it when I'm whipping through, I'll tell everybody how much it is. We also had the most expensive one, I think, in here was Dracula, which was a first American edition, and it was signed by Bram Stoker. Bram Stoker actually didn't start out as an author. He managed a theater, the Lyceum Theater. But he traveled. I know he traveled with Ellen Terry and some of the actors to America, and he signed this copy for an American. And I just thought it was really neat. The theme this year of our event, we do an adopt a book event every year where you have to buy tickets and you come. And
but that's in Washington D.C., right?
Always at the castle, the right. Smithsonian castle
right.
that everybody has pictures of. And but the theme this year was a celebration of food and drink. So I was wondering, why was Dracula in there?
He drank blood, apparently, right?
That's right.
I don't know. Stretching the imagination there a little bit.
They also have the joys of Jell-O gelatin dessert. And that's from General Foods in 1963. And I guess that's fairly scarce. It's just so much fun to see all these books, and you can see them. They have pictures of them online at smithsonianlibraries.edu. One of the ones I thought was so fascinating, speaking of food, was the Wonder Book of Good Meals. It turns out that Wonder Bread was the first sliced bread. They had a
yes.
bread slicer at the Chicago World's Fair in 1934, and that all the different recipes that you could do with this once bread got sliced, and I guess that must be where the expression came from, is, you know, more exciting than sliced bread or more important than sliced bread.
Yeah, that book came out around 1934, so these are old books. Dracula was, of course, 1899, so... But it sounds like a fascinating program, a great program to help preserve literary history. We're right at the end of our segment here. So can we get the website at the URL again, if you would share that with us? That would be great.
Yes, it's library.si, library, singular, .si.edu/donate/adopt-a-book.
Right. And if you can't remember that, I do know you can just go Google Smithsonian Adopt-a-Book Program and the...
Oh, it has to be Smithsonian Libraries.
Smithsonian Libraries Adopt-a-Book Program, and that will pop right up. Catherine Neville, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky. It's been a thrill. Thanks.
And thank you for joining us today. We appreciate you spending this hour with us. If you have any questions or feedback, comments on today's show or suggestions for future topics, you know where to reach me, info@conversationslive.net. If you have a spare few minutes and haven't had a chance yet to fill out the KKNW survey, it greatly helps the radio station And it also helps me as a host to tailor programming to meet your needs. So go to 1150kknw.com and click on the words 2016 listener survey, which is right at the top of the page. And as I said, there it's a great opportunity to let us know what you like and dislike. It's also, if you choose to share your email address, as an added bonus, they will enter you for the drawing to win a prize. And you can find all of that at 1150kknw.com. And as I said, if you have questions or feedback, you can find me at info@conversationslive or at 800-495-7617. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.